Welcome to Open Your Eyes, a podcast about opening our eyes to a new view of life. Thanks for joining us today. I hope you're doing well and you had an amazing week since joining our last podcast. You know, our days are often filled with routines and habits that keep us moving without really seeing life as it really is. And yet, there's so much happening all around us, opportunities, stories, lessons, that we can miss if we don't pause and open our eyes to notice. So what we do here at Open Your Eyes is to help us see things in a new light and bring a bit more perspective and discovery to your way of thinking. I hope that happens today. Let's get started. Conversation is at the heart of human experience, and research shows that we spend 30% of our waking hours talking with team members, friends, partners, children, neighbors, and people we've met for the first time. Yet, most of us have never taken a course on conversation. We may have been trained on how to make a presentation, but what about conversation? For most of us, we think conversation is just something that happens naturally. If it flows, great. If it doesn't, we stumble and hope for the best. But there are those among us who work at conversation. Why? Because they have more influence, they connect with people better, and they have more success in their business and life as a result. And the truth is that psychologists, behavioral scientists, and communication researchers all agree that conversation is a skill. Like running, computer coding, or speaking a second language, it can be practiced, improved, and mastered. And becoming skilled at conversation doesn't just make social interactions easier, it has measurable effect on your life. People who connect deeply with others are happier, more resilient, and even live longer. They're more persuasive at work, more trusted as leaders, and more supported in moments of stress. Think about your business. How important is conversation in what you do? You meet people, you add their names to your contact list. As an employee, you engage with people to further your work. Isn't conversation one of the most important things that you do? Early in her career, Brené Brown was a research professor at the University of Houston, studying shame and vulnerability. She realized that her academic knowledge alone wouldn't connect with people, and she needed to communicate in a human way. She noticed that when she spoke in purely formal academic language, audiences would nod politely but remain emotionally distant. People remembered the data but didn't feel moved or inspired. So she began intentionally practicing her conversation skills. She started by observing herself and others in interactions. She practiced listening without planning her next comment. Instead of trying to sound smart, she focused on understanding what others were truly feeling. In her book, Dare to Lead, she talks about how she sought feedback from colleagues and students. She would ask, "Did that feel authentic?" or "Did you feel heard?" She learned to adjust her tone, timing, and approach based on real responses, a methodical approach to improving conversational impact. Brown made a conscious decision to share her own experiences of failure, embarrassment, and shame. She would practice telling these stories in small settings like workshops or classroom discussions, paying attention to how people responded when she revealed real emotion. She noticed that when she allowed herself to be human, people leaned in rather than pulling away. The result of this intentional practice was profound. Her TED talk, The Power of Vulnerability, became one of the most viewed talks in history, not because the research was new, but because she had practiced connecting through conversation at a deep level. The trust and empathy she built in her small-scale interactions scaled to millions of viewers. The stakes of conversation are higher than most people realize. One famous study of airline pilots found that communication breakdowns were a leading factor in cockpit errors. In hospitals, decades of research from Dr. Wendy Levinson have shown that the way doctors speak to patients, the questions they ask, the kindness they show, and the attention that they give predicts whether those doctors will be sued or not for malpractice. She learned that doctors who were skilled conversationalists and skilled at educating patients about what to expect and the flow of the visit, those who laughed and used humor more, and those that were skilled at soliciting patients' opinions, checking understanding, and encouraging them to talk, these were the doctors who had a lower incidence of malpractice. They had a better practice because they had better conversation skills. Conversation isn't trivial. It's how we shape the world around us and influence others and create trust. Yet, many of us treat it like small talk or an afterthought. So let's explore a few ways to improve our conversation skills. Alison Brooks, in her book, Talk, The Science of Conversation and the Art of Being Ourselves, points out that we have an extremely broad and varied collection of conversations throughout our day on a variety of topics. Perhaps you're talking with a friend about the struggles she's having with children, or how to grow your team at work, or to a doctor about medical-related issues, and so forth. Each day, you change topics or purposes dozens, if not hundreds of times. Therefore, conversation is really a large collection of micro-decisions about how to relate in a specific situation. And being skilled at these decisions and conversations takes work. So, Brooks lays out a professional framework summarized in four key principles, T-A-L-K, topics, asking, levity, and kindness. Now, these principles are deceptively simple, but I found they work. The first principle is the T in talk and stands for topics. Most people fear preparing for a conversation because they worry it will sound rehearsed. And research proves the opposite. A study from Harvard University's Department of Psychology found that people who prepared two or three small topics before entering a social interaction reported lower anxiety, higher enjoyment, and better conversational flow. I do this. Much of my current work at my foundation is fundraising. I meet with a number of new people each week to try to develop a bit of a relationship and to share information, all in hopes of influencing them. So I prepare in advance based on what I know about them. I've learned that preparation frees your mind to listen and engage more authentically in the conversation. I find it gives me confidence. For example, I recently met with the owner of a large construction company. Beforehand, I learned about some of his work and people that he's worked with. I thought through what topics I would bring up, and this allowed me to have a conversation in which, when he shared what he had done in his past, I knew a little bit about it. In our conversation, one of the topics I planned for was his work, his business. And I asked him, "I heard you worked on such and such project. Is that the first theater that you've built?" He answered, "No, we are in fact one of the largest theater builders." "Really?" I said. "How did you become a theater builder?" And this opened the way for more connection. The topic I was prepared for was his work, and I wanted to learn more about him. You see, preparation moves the conversation to more meaningful places. I found it also lets you be more free and confident in your conversation. NASA provides a perfect example of this. During shuttle missions, astronauts and mission control meticulously plan every conversation. They anticipate questions. They prepare key discussion points. They coordinate hundreds of small, high-stakes tasks. And this structured approach ensures clarity and trust. Preparation doesn't make the conversation mechanical. It allows the human connection to flourish. Preparing topics doesn't take away from authenticity. It creates space for presence. Even in emergency medicine, doctors pre-plan conversational structures for triage. Key questions allow them to assess patients quickly while leaving room for human connection. And this reduces stress for both doctor and patient. It fosters trust and improves outcomes. So let's say today you'll be connecting with a high potential client. Get prepared a bit. What topics do you want to prepare for? If you're hoping to talk about their health goals, prepare for that topic. Think through your conversation. In writing about a now very famous study, one author wrote, John Gottman, a psychology professor and researcher at the University of Washington, interviewed and observed 130 newlywed couples as they carried out everyday tasks such as cooking, cleaning, listening to music, and talking to each other. Over 90% of the time, Gottman was able to accurately predict whether the couple would still be together several years later. How was he able to make these predictions? By observing the degree to which the couples accepted the bids of the other in a conversation. He noticed that one person in the marriage would make a bid. A bid was a conversation starter or observation. The husband might say, "Look at that beautiful bird outside." The positivity or negativity or even indifference in the response from his wife was measured. Based solely on the kindness and willingness of that response, researchers could predict with 94% certainty whether couples, rich or poor, childless or not, whatever their situation, would be broken up together and unhappy or together and happy several years later. How do you accept the bid from another person in a conversation? Do you listen and engage in that topic? Or do you do things like always talk about yourself? I have a coworker that when I put out a bid like, "I really like Jane, she's such a hard worker," the coworker will accept my bid, but make it about her. "Yes, I've learned a long time ago to be a hard worker." Now, the bid was about Jane, and she could have easily said, "Jane's such an example to her team," but she makes it all about herself instead. Now, some people think that in conversations that by oversharing about yourself, you're relating more. And in some cases, this may be true. But if you only accept bids by talking about yourself, perhaps you're talking about yourself too much. Using Gottman's example of a bid, "Look at the beautiful bird outside," could be responded to by saying, "I love the color of its wings," rather than talking about your experience in birdwatching. Conversation and bid making and bid taking is a skill. Sometimes you can share a personal experience, but I've learned that accepting a bid in a way that points to the other person is most effective, such as, "Have you ever gone birdwatching?" Now, let's move on to our other talk principle. The A in talk stands for asking. Skilled conversationalists know how to ask questions, and this is what Brooks wrote to introduce the topic. Carrie Fisher was 2 years old when her parents separated, and it became the biggest tabloid scandal of the day. Her mother was Debbie Reynolds, who starred in Singin' in the Rain. Her father was the pop singer Eddie Fisher. For years, her parents had been close with the Hollywood icon, Elizabeth Taylor. Reynolds and Taylor had been childhood friends. When Elizabeth Taylor's husband died in a plane crash in 1958, Eddie Fisher rushed to her side to comfort her. Then he decided to stay there, and he left Debbie Reynolds to raise their two young kids, Todd and Carrie, by herself. Carrie, as a teenager, played a supporting role to her mother in the Broadway musical Irene. When she was in her 20s, her portrayal of Princess Leia in Star Wars launched her into superstardom. Alongside her fame, Fisher struggled with bipolar disorder and drug abuse. In the mid-1980s, she nearly overdosed and had to check into rehab. Well, a few years later, Fisher appeared as a guest on the program Fresh Air on NPR. The executive producer, Terry Gross, interviewed Fisher. In the interview, Gross and Fisher discuss Fisher's new movie, her book, her relationship with her mother, and her struggles with mental health. Once, after a relatively innocuous question about the types of roles that Fisher gets, Gross seems to sense, in the conversation, that she has permission to ask a higher-level question. "Did nearly ODing and then recovering from your drug habit change the kind of acting you wanted to do, or the way people perceived you who were casting you?" Gross asks. It's a jarring, intimate question, but Gross delivers it with warmth and disarming directness. Fisher responds in kind, describing how her bad reputation lingers in the movie business. Well, Gross acknowledges Fisher's disclosure with an understated "mm." Then, to avoid lingering too long on a heavy topic, steps gracefully down the topic pyramid by asking about Fisher's early career. Fisher makes wry jokes and Gross laughs easily and generously. To listeners, such a conversation between two pros makes for great entertainment. But the interview didn't have to go as well as it did. And one reason it did was Gross's skillful questioning. Her questions guided the topics, unearthed new revelations, and seemingly brought Fisher and herself closer together. Each question was an invitation for Fisher to make herself known. Why didn't you star in your own film? Could you elaborate on that? What kinds of things did you and your mother fight about? What was your audition like for Star Wars? Did you ever regret dropping out of school? The questions provided a brilliant skeleton for the conversation, a skeleton fleshed out by Fisher's responses. Here's the point. Skilled questioning is important to almost any conversation, and the quality of your follow-up questions, questions that respond to what someone has just said, is one of the most consistent predictors of likability, trust, and engagement. Asking demonstrates curiosity and attention. It signals, I hear you. I want to understand. Andrew Warner, founder of the interview series Mixergy, learned this firsthand. In his early interviews, he tried to impress guests with his clever questions. Guests remained guarded, but then he got some advice from a famous entrepreneur who said, "You're leading too hard. You're not following." Warner then shifted to curiosity. He listened, he asked thoughtful follow-up questions, and he let guests guide the conversation. The result? Deeper discussions, more openness, and exponential growth of his show. So in your business, in your daily conversations, how good are you at asking skilled follow-up questions to show your interest in the other person? If you're skilled at this, it's likely you can develop more trust and be more influential. Satya Nadella at Microsoft demonstrated this principle. Upon becoming CEO, he spent months visiting employees at all levels, asking questions, not to gather data, but to genuinely understand people's experiences. His follow-up questions, asked with warmth and curiosity, built trust and helped transform Microsoft's culture into one of collaboration and innovation. And here's what I've learned about asking questions in a conversation. Authenticity is most important. Do you genuinely want to know about the other person or the topic at hand? If you do, then the genuine way of responding will happen with ease. Your goal isn't to show how smart you are. It's to learn about the other person. So approach the question with genuine curiosity. For example, instead of saying, "What do you do?" try, "What's the most exciting part of your work?" I've always liked the question when talking about another person's profession, "Do you like what you do?" It always opens the door to the conversation. When someone shares something meaningful, echo part of it in your next question. For instance, if they say, "I've been learning a lot about sustainable farming," you might ask, "What's been the most surprising thing you've learned?" This shows you're listening and keeps the conversation flowing naturally. Remember, a skilled conversationalist spaces questions with comments, reactions, or small stories of their own. Conversation is a rhythm, not a Q&A session. A small story of your own might be, "I know what you mean. I tried to help my child with their math, but I've forgotten almost everything. So I sneak into the other room, ask ChatGPT the question, and come back as if I knew it all along." Short, fun, interesting, and most of all, build on the conversation. So, what if the conversation stalls? How do you use a question to reignite it? I have put into practice something I read years ago, and it's the combination of observe and ask. Here's an example. "I heard you collect cars. Is that true? What's your favorite?" Now, I'm not talking about awkward observe and ask questions like, "I noticed you're pregnant," but something more skillful, such as, "I noticed you talking to John. Do you know him well?" The observe or notice part gives relevance for the question that follows. Okay, let's move on to the L in talk. It stands for levity. Levity is the principle of lightness in a conversation. It's warmth. It's small jokes, smiles, gentle humor. It's not about performing or entertaining. It's about creating a safe environment for dialogue. Allison Brooks shares this experience about a speed dating experiment that was conducted. The students were strangers to each other. They were going in totally cold. They weren't connected through mutual friends. No online profiles were reviewed beforehand. It was before dating apps became popular. They'd signed up to do this meet new people with no guarantee about finding commonalities, only the hope that they might. Two daters sit across from each other at one of many small tables in the noisy restaurant, Tom and Cassie. They've already spent some time moving around the room and talking to other people, so they know the drill. And as soon as the timer goes off, they'll have 4 minutes to get to know each other, then they must move on. Before the timer starts, the two get some quick words in, joking over how they feel at this speed dating thing. "I don't think I'm really doing very good at this," Cassie offers. "Yeah, I messed up," Don says. "I totally screwed up on the first 5 or 6. They laugh, and she asks if he has enough water. "Oh, I never had enough water to begin with," he said. "I don't know how everyone else has water except me." They laugh again. Still waiting for the timer to start, the two continue. "It's like a rotating merry-go-round," she says. "I feel like I'm just reciting lines from a script," Tom agrees. "So you're not going to become a professional speed dater?" he asks, and they laugh again. The buzzer goes off. Time to get to know each other. "We're allowed to talk now," Tom announces. But instead of getting down to business, he revisits their shared plight. "It's so awkward," he says, "to speak into a recorder." He's burning precious time. "I don't think they're getting, like, good data," he laments. They laugh again. So far, he's kicked off the conversation with 4 innocuous jokes. Perhaps encouraged by the laughs, he offers a new topic. "He's studying computer science." "Really?" Cassie replies. She wouldn't have taken him for a computer science guy. They trade a few notes. She's studying law, and he's in computers because he didn't want to get a PhD on the technicalities of Hamlet. She misses teaching, and then she asks where he's from. "Florida," he replies. "I'm from the South too," Cassie says, "although Florida is not really the South, but no," he agrees, "Florida is just a weird place." He's using self-deprecation to support her position, and he wants to know where she's from. "Are you from Texas?" he asks, and the conversation is already a success because of levity. In MIT's Human Dynamics Lab, they found that social signals, small smiles, laughter, and shared micro moments, predicted team success more than intelligence or experience. Teams that shared warmth performed better, communicated more clearly, and were more resilient under stress. So, how do we learn to use levity? It's a unique combination of playfulness, acceptance, and lightheartedness that includes not taking yourself too seriously. I've learned that self-deprecating humor done the right way always works. Yes, self-deprecation. Most of us think poorly of ourselves already, at least sometimes, so why should we let all of that self-loathing go to waste? Self-deprecation works best when leaders and high-status group members share something they've overcome or criticisms they've received earlier in their life. I'll give you a perfect example. My wife and I started early having children. Our plan was once we started having kids that we were going to be miserable and tired, so why not compact the kids together so we could enjoy the second half of our lives when they left the house? So one day we were standing in line at a restaurant, and I used something that I'd heard in my past as we started a conversation with a few people standing in line. We were outside the restaurant waiting for our number to be called. Our 4 very young kids at the time were running around yelling and doing stupid things. We struck up a conversation with the couple that were there next to us with 1 baby in tow. As we talked, they asked us, "If you could do it again, would you have 4 kids?" To which I replied, signaling to the chaos in front of us, "Not these 4. Levity is learned and practiced. And the more you practice, the better you become. Next, the K in talk is for kindness. How do you portray kindness in a conversation? And the answer to that is authentically. I've learned that when you genuinely want to be a person who is kind and practices kindness, that the behavior will genuinely emerge. A few years ago, the company MetLife implemented an aptitude test before hiring salespeople, and they found that the aptitude test helped predict the later success of the employees. But then they added a second test, a kindness test. And this is where it gets interesting. Those sales reps who scored high on the positive test but failed the aptitude test outperformed those who passed the aptitude test. And they did so by 21% in the first year and a massive 57% in year two. The data was indisputable. Positive kindness heavily correlates to predicting a salesperson's success, even more than aptitude. So, if you're building a business, remember that kindness in your conversation will likely have more impact than just about anything. I love talking to kind people. I love talking to people who are positive. These skills will help you become more skilled in your conversation. So, as we end today, remember the four talk principles: topics, ask questions, levity, and kindness, and try putting them to use in your conversations each day. And watch. You'll find that your conversations, your influence, and your joy in connecting with other people will grow. Most of all, thanks for being here today. And don't forget to join us next week for another podcast as we seek to open our eyes to who and what we can become.